Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Dr. Jared Rubin, an associate professor of economics at Chapman University, interested in the economic history of the Middle East and Western Europe. His research focuses on relationships between political and religious institutions and their role in economic development. He graduated with a PhD in economics from Stanford University in 2007 and a BA from the University of Virginia in 2002. Moreover, Jared serves as the Associate Director of Chapman University's Institute for Religion, Economics, and Society. For those of you who are graduate students listening to this program, or undergraduates considering advanced degrees with a focus on religion, that institute is now offering training seminars that provide you with the opportunity to travel to sunny Southern California and learn from some of the best scholars in the field, and includes many guests that we've actually had on this program before, so always look into those opportunities. Professor Rubin is a workhorse of an author and has published articles in several journals, such as the Review of Economic Studies, Review of Economics and Statistics, Economic Journal, and a whole lot others. He is currently writing a book under contract with Cambridge University Press, tentatively entitled God, Power, and Printing. Or perhaps it's entitled Rulers, Religion, and Riches. We'll figure that out in a minute. But that book is going to examine the long-run economic consequences of differing political and religious institutions in the Middle East and Western Europe. And that will, in part, form the basis of our conversation today. Jared maintains a spiffy website of his own where you can find his writings and musings, and we will certainly link to it at our website, so as soon as you finish listening here today, go over there and visit Dr. Rubin. Jared, you're a return guest, so welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's a pleasure to be back.
That book you are working on, I went and looked up your bio, and I saw one working title, then I went to another page, and I saw another working title. What's going on there? Have you finalized the title yet?
I have finalized the title. It was a pretty long process there. The original title was thought up by my wife, so you know, you have to stick with that, of course, as long as one can. Originally going with something along the lines of Guns, Germs, and Steel, you know, pretty popular book, which I like, and I think a nicely titled book as well. So my wife came up with God, Power, and Printing, knowing that my book was about both the kind of this intersection between religion and politics, and the power part. And printing does play a role in the story I tell in the book. But some conversations with both editors, as well as a book conference I had at Mercatus Center at George Mason University, suggested, you know, printing isn't really that central, or it's not central enough. And, you know, alliteration sells, so I changed it to Rulers, Religion, and Riches is the main part. So, and that really gets at the three central aspects of the book, you know, rulers and religion being the two things I look at the interaction of, but I'm really concerned as an economist on the economic consequences, you know, the riches, so to speak.
Yeah, that is good. So you got three R's there. You're right, alliteration does sell, and you can say the triple R book. That's what it'll be.
That's right.
Not triple X, but the triple R book. Although I have to admit, I like God, Power, and Printing, too. That would have sold me, but...
I do. Yeah. I like it, too.
Yeah. You can tell your wife I like it, so it works out really good. Today, we want to spend some time talking about a component part of your larger research agenda, which is on the historical economic development of the Middle East and West Europe, and focus on a paper that you're writing with Timur Kuran, a professor over at Duke and another frequent guest on our podcast. The title of that paper, if it hasn't changed since I've read it, is The Financial Power of the Powerless, Socioeconomic Status and Interest Rates Under Partial Rule of Law,
first part of that title catches my attention. Second one, might put me asleep a little bit, but it actually is a pretty fascinating paper. It is a great one because normally today in our conversations about economics, we usually assume that the upper class, the top 1%ers or maybe the top 10%ers always get their way with everything. But this doesn't always happen to be the case. So let's go ahead and find out why. Take us back in time and space. And the focus of your study, where is it at time-wise and spatially?
So time-wise, our paper looks at the 17th and 18th century. So specifically 1602 through 1799. So a nearly 200-year period. And the paper focuses on Istanbul, the capital of the Ottoman Empire. And this is a fascinating city at the time for many reasons. One is it's quite possibly the most diverse city in many ways in the world at the time. So religiously, it's extremely diverse. It is majority Muslim, but just barely. It's about 58% Muslim, about 5 to 10% Jewish, and the rest are Christian. So there's a lot of diversity there. One thing that economists will care about too is the distribution of assets. And one thing that this is actually true among most Muslim societies at the time is that assets are distributed a little more equally among genders in Istanbul than elsewhere. So females actually have quite a non-trivial portion of assets. They don't nearly have a majority by any means, but this is also something which is, in a sense, unique, especially relative to Western Europe or, relative to what we generally think of as pre-modern societies. So this is the context in which our study takes place. It's one of the most important cities in the Eastern Mediterranean, at least, probably the most important city in the Eastern Mediterranean, certainly in the entire Ottoman Empire, which at this time spans southeastern Europe, into even parts of Central Europe, the North African coast, the Arabian Peninsula, much of what we think of as the modern Middle East today, as far east as the border of Iran. Now, over this period, the 17th and 18th century, the borders are starting to shrink a little bit. This is the decline of the Ottoman Empire. But it's still a kind of a fascinating place to study for these reasons. And just because they kept good data too. They kept good records.
Yeah, that is always helpful. Something that you said really piqued my interest, and that probably comes as a surprise to a lot of other folks as well. I mean, this is during the Ottoman Caliphate. So you figure this is Muslim Empire, but Istanbul, it's a little less than 60% Muslim. And what do you say about 35 or so percent Christian, 5%? Jewish there. So how does that come about? I mean, most people think that, the Muslims roll into town and everybody else is kicked out. Is it because it's a central place of trade markets that cross paths? What's going on there?
Well, so there's some of that, of course. Istanbul is the most important city in the Anatolian Peninsula at the time. But, there's a few things especially if you don't know much about the Ottoman Empire, to know or to remember that the Ottoman Empire as a whole was very diverse, so really the first place after modern-day Turkey that the Ottomans conquered was southeastern Europe, so the Balkans, Greece, into Hungary, Romania, much of which actually remained Christian, some of which converted, so modern-day Albania, but much of which actually stayed Christian, so a good chunk of the population, the Ottoman Empire, was actually Christian. And, of course, some of these people ended up in Istanbul, because that's generally what happens with capitals. And Istanbul is also a center of trade, so a lot of Christian and Jewish merchants would have been there. But also, so prior to 1453, when the Ottomans conquered Istanbul, or at the time it was called Constantinople, it was the capital of the Byzantine Empire, which was Christian. And so it had always been a melting pot city, and it's not as if once the Ottomans conquered the city, everyone just converted. Now, they did try to convert many people, and many Muslims moved into the city, but it by no means became just a Muslim city overnight or even over the course of a century. It remained and you know, still today is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world, probably. But at the time, it was, you know, still a very diverse place.
What is happening politically there, and then also legally? Because we're going to get into the thicket of the laws and the legal structure there, but just give us a brief overview. It's a caliphate, so it's kind of like a monarchy. And are we dealing with Sharia law here? Is there civil law? What does it look like?
Sure. So start with politically. There's the Sultan at the center, of course, and the Sultan sits in Istanbul, the capital. And the Sultan has different groups of people which, you know, legitimize his rule. So the religious establishment plays a very important role in this process. Now, as you were kind of alluding to here, the religious establishment is not just religious, they're also legal. So, and this is true across all Muslim societies for the most part, that the, you know, religious jurists are the legal jurists. So Sharia law does play an important role. Now, in the Ottoman Empire, there was also secular law, known as the Kanun, which essentially was the law that the Ottomans used for purposes of the state. So the things that the Sultan wanted to have, you know, in laws of taxation and things like this, they had their own law that was outside the Sharia law. Now, importantly for the economy, however, most commercial law remained under the purview of the religious establishment. So if you had a case, you know, as we'll be talking about here, on a loan or something that went bad, this would have been fallen under commercial law, and it would have gone to an Islamic court, at least if it were a loan between at least one Muslim.
Okay. Yep, that's something we're going to dig into as well here. So that's interesting. There is some notion of secular law going on there, and I can imagine that causes conflict at various points in time between religious leaders.
Yeah, and over time, if there was a dispute between two Christians, say, they could actually go to a Christian court as well.
Oh.
Same with Jews. They had jurisdiction. But if one side was Muslim, if it was, say, the case between a Muslim and a Christian, you still had to go to the Islamic court.
So wait, let me get this straight here. So there's a bunch of Christians. It's a sizable minority. And if there's two disputes, or if there's a dispute between two Christians, they can take it to their own religious court, or does it go to the Sultanate secular court?
They can take it to their own court.
Okay. So there's canon law courts that are existing at this time.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how. So Timur Karan, my co-author on this as well, my advisor, has written a lot about this, talks about this extensively in some of his work and his book, actually, his recent book as well, that, you know, there are these competing jurisdictions that you can go to, and they actually become secular over time, the European ones, but it's not canon law so much as it is European law, so civil or common law, depending on which country the litigants end up going to.
Now, there's one aspect, too, that you mentioned a bit earlier that puzzled me and it probably surprised a number of listeners as well, is females held a substantial amount of the assets, you know, physical capital and financial assets. Again, that's somewhat discongruous with what we'd be thinking about a modern Muslim society where we think of women as kind of being subservient. What is going on that women have so much control over the wealth back then?
So the primary and almost sole reason for this is that Islamic law of inheritance was relatively equal. It wasn't equal by any means, but relative to, say, you know, primogeniture law in Europe, there were predetermined splits of inheritance between men and women, or, you know, really, you know, sons and daughters and cousins, etc. And women generally, depending on their status, received half as much as men. So, you know, if it were, say, for a simplistic example, just one brother and one sister, the man would have received 2/3 and the woman would have received 1/3 of the inheritance. So by standards of the early modern period, the pre-modern period even, this was actually pretty progressive. And women ended up, because of this, having more assets than they did in most other places in the world that we know of, and certainly, for the most part, in Europe. Women did have some assets in Europe, but there's pretty good evidence that, as a whole, they had more assets
The Ottoman Empire.
Okay. That's very interesting, too, just to think about how that has progressed. Do you have any thoughts on whether or not this dissipated over time? Do women still kind of benefit from these laws in contemporary periods, or do you not know?
So not as much, in the sense that the Western, if you compare to the what we think of the Western, Western Europe, U.S., whatnot, their laws have become much more progressive since then. So now, compared to Islamic law of inheritance, the Islamic law of inheritance is not so generous to women compared to the West. But this was something that came later. This was something that came, at least in the West, in the more like in the modern period, when wills really were freed of these old feudal things, where it would essentially be the oldest male getting most of the wealth.
Okay. So we're talking here, we're in the 17th, 18th century in the Ottoman Empire, specifically Istanbul. That's the focus of your study in terms of time and space. But you also focus substantively on credit institutions. That's how we lend and we borrow money. It occurs in all economies. Talk a little bit about this. We hear a great deal about anti-usury laws and why charging interest to people, or specifically your brethren, is bad. Can an economy really run with an absolute prohibition on interest?
No, not really. So the idea behind this was that from the get-go, almost, in Muslim societies, and this well predates the Ottomans, so just for listeners who don't know this history, the Ottoman Empire formally begins in 1299, really doesn't get going until the 15th century. This is a half millennium after Muhammad. So in that intervening period prior to the Ottomans, there was actually the golden age of Islam, when commerce in the Middle East, trade in the Middle East, flowed much heavier volume than in Western Europe. And really from the get-go, the ban on usury, or the ban on any interest at all, in the Quran was evaded through ruses. So the most famous ruse, the double sale, where I say, I sell you a computer, for example, or something of value, say for $100, and then you buy it back immediately from me for $110 payable in a year. So really, nothing actually ends up trading hands, and it's a loan at $100 at 10% interest. That's a way to do a loan between two people, either who know each other, or maybe don't know each other, but might be able to get that backed up in an Islamic court, because the Islamic law actually approves of that, because formally it's two sales, both of which are legal in Islamic law, and judges would support this. And what we end up seeing in the data we have, which we'll talk about in a second, but this is still going on in the Ottoman Empire. You had to at least appeal to these ruses. There was no such thing as just a flat-out loan at 10% interest. You still had to say you were doing something, even if you might not have ended up doing it. Now, that being said, this did have a rather dampening effect on institutional lending. So one thing we know from this period, and we see in the data that we'll talk about here, is that there's no real institutionalized lending, meaning no banks. It's all people lending to other people. Or they have these things called cash waqfs. A waqf is a trust where somebody that's relatively wealthy can put their money in a trust for generally their son or daughter to use. But this was also just one person lending out essentially their wealth to another person. So all the data we see, and there's been other studies that have looked at lending markets in the Ottoman Empire, they all more or less see the same thing. There's always some appeal to some type of ruse. And then people just lend it, generally. So there were caps. So around 15% is generally a broadly seen cap, that over time and space seems to be pretty persistent, even though, there are plenty of instances where people go above that in times of inflation.
Yeah, so those ruses that you're talking about, that's something you call disguised interest. There's also a term that you use in your paper called moderate interest. And so is this above board lending that you say, excessive interest is not good, maybe 20% is too much, but 7% seems moderate.
Exactly. So even today, you know, so today we, you know, we're using this term usury. In the pre-modern period, usury was a term for any interest at all. Today, when we mention the term usury, we actually think of something that's still criminal, but it just means really high interest. So, you know, like 100% interest on a credit card or something would be considered usurious. So, you know, there are credit card laws in the United States, you know, they differ by state, that cap how much interest can be charged on loans. So that's considered usurious. Of course, anything below that cap is considered fine. This was also true in the Ottoman Empire. So the same broadly across time and space, 15% was generally considered okay, anything there or below. But exceptions were commonly given above 15% too. Now, we rarely see at least nominal rates much above 30%, suggesting that, you know, there was something to these caps.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because even today, you know, interest rates above 30% per annum are quite common, at least in the U.S., for the poor, you know, borrowing from payday lenders, pawn shops, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question about the usury laws with respect to the religious diversity in the area, too. Did usury laws only apply from Muslim to Muslim? Could a Muslim lend money to a Christian and charge 25% interest? Or was there some standardization across denominational lending?
No, so Muslims were not supposed to lend at interest at all, so regardless of who it was to. So that, so those laws applied regardless of who they were lending to. Jews, on the other hand, and this also became important in medieval Europe, so there's a passage in Deuteronomy that prohibits Jews from lending to other Jews at interest, but it explicitly says, you know, it's only members of the tribe you're not allowed to, so Jews are allowed to lend to others at interest, you know, whatever interest they want. So there's really no problem with that in terms of Jews lending to Christians and Muslims. Now, there was a also a ban that Christians abided by for over a millennium of lending at interest, but by the period we look at, the 17th and 18th century, that is a dead letter. The Christians have been lending at interest at this period, you know, more or less since about the 14th century, pretty openly at interest. So no, in a sense, it didn't really matter whether you were a Muslim, you know, you weren't supposed to lend. Christians could lend, Jews could lend at interest.
So is it possible for, if a Muslim can't lend, is it possible for a Jew to lend money at interest to a Muslim?
Yeah.
Okay. And yeah. So it's okay for the Muslim to accept that?
Yes.
Okay.
But really, what was really going on, though, is Muslims could lend to Muslims at interest. They just wouldn't call it interest-bearing loan.
Right.
They would appeal to some ruse.
Yeah.
And it would be the same thing.
That was the big story here, and that's what gets us into this interesting paradox. You mentioned a moment ago that here in the United States, payday loans to poor people usually come at really high interest rates, but you find something very different in the Ottoman Empire in the 17th and 18th century, which makes the paper just absolutely fascinating, creates a very interesting empirical puzzle. And to get to that point, you have to think about the people who are there, who are doing the lending. You can think of the poor and the rich, but you introduced two concepts into this paper that I think are more useful, and that is financial power and legal power. Explain what those are and how they matter for an economy in general.
So by financial power, we mean specifically with regard, you know, because we're interested in lending here. Financial power is the power to borrow cheaply. Essentially. Now, generally, for good reasons, when markets are working, we think, the main reason that one might have financial power, at least the power to borrow cheaply, is that they're less likely to default on the loan. That's one of the main things that a lender is thinking about when he or she is looking at a borrower that they're going to lend to, as well, am I going to get my money back? Am I going to get the interest that's promised here? So we say financial power is generally, you know, generally very highly correlated with wealth, because the wealthier you are, the more likely it is you're going to pay back the loan. This is why in the U.S. today, and it's not even the wealthy, but the middle class and lower middle class have access to credit cards. because they're likely to be able to eventually pay back any credit card debt they take on. Whereas poor people or people with bad credit history have much worse access to credit cards because they no longer have financial power, because as we define it here, because they are likely to default, and thus if they are going to borrow, they have to go to people who are going to charge them much higher rates. You know, in the U.S. today, credit cards, you know, you can get credit cards around 13 to 20%, something like that. Whereas if you go to a payday lender and you annualize out the rate, it's something 400 to 500% per year. So that's what we mean by financial power. Now, legal power, on the other hand, is really the concept, in a sense, we're introducing here, obviously not that term, but the concept and how it relates to economic, or in this case, credit outcomes. And this is not something we think about in the modern context, at least in the modern developed world, because it's not something that really enters into the calculation. But it does enter into the calculation in the Ottoman world. Now, what we mean by legal power is the power to win lawsuits that others would not win, essentially, all else equal. So I have legal power if over you, say Tony, if we have the same exact case at court, but I'm just more likely to win than you are. Okay. So now, one major caveat here, because I think some listeners might immediately say, well, you know, that's actually not true that there's not legal power in the U.S. And that'd be correct. So it's actually true today, too, in the U.S., you know, Europe, wherever. The wealthy do have some legal power over the poor, mainly because they can hire better lawyers. You know, so, you know, if a wealthy person and a poor person go to court, the wealthy person is more likely to win because they have better lawyers. But what this really is a relative concept. In matters of finance in the U.S., there is a little bit of legal power, but it's not so strong. In the Ottoman Empire, it was built into the law, legal power. So certain classes had more legal power than others. And again, all we mean by this is they were more likely to win a court case, all else equal, than other classes.
So it's baked into the law. And according to certain categories, who are the certain categories? And again, I just looking at contemporary times, one would immediately think, well, the wealthy are going to benefit from legal power because, you know, they're the ones who have all this stuff and junk and they can influence the people who make the laws. So
exactly. So on one hand, yeah, they do. So there is a benefit to being wealthier. We actually, so in our data, we see it's what people we call elite. And all we mean by elite here is in Ottoman society, there were certain people that had titles. So people with titles had a significant amount of legal power for a couple reasons. The main one being that it's an especially in Ottoman society, in Istanbul, which was the capital, most people with titles had some connection to the Sultan. Now the Sultan and the Sultan's hierarchy was also responsible for hiring and rotating judges. So if you were a judge with any type of career ambition, one thing you did not want to do was to piss off the Sultan's friend, essentially. So what this meant is that all else equal, if you were an elite, if you had a title, you were much more likely to win a case. And Timur's actually done some work besides this that shows this is definitely true. It's a very strong effect that you can look at different aspects of the case. And if you had a title, you're just more likely to win. Again, and this has to do with the political economy and really the political and legal economy of pre-modern Istanbul. So elites were one group that had legal power. Now, there were two other groups that had legal power. And these had more to do, actually, with Islamic law, namely Muslims and women. So Muslims versus non-Muslims, Muslims and men, and men versus women. And one of the main reasons is that to convict a Muslim or a man required more witnesses than convicting a non-Muslim or a woman. So this is actually part of Islamic law that does favor Muslims and men vis-a-vis non-Muslims and women, respectively. Now, one other thing that's less part of the law itself and more part of Ottoman society, which gave men or what we kind of call legal power here, is that in cases of borrowing, it was much easier for a man to run away, to flee. So if the man couldn't repay a loan, one thing you can do is just flee, never be seen from again. In Ottoman society, as well as actually in some Muslim societies today, you know, a woman that was out there on her own would be looked at as very suspicious. So this gave a certain amount of, you know, of power to men to, you know, once that contract was made, to be able to renege with impunity.
I see where this is going. So here, if I'm thinking about this in contemporary period, you talk about these people who have greater legal power, elites, Muslims versus non-Muslims, and men versus women. It would just seem obvious then that with all this legal power, they'd be able to soak up all the cheap capital, so they'd have a ton of economic power when it came to credit, right?
So you would think that, but really what we find is actually the opposite. And this is where I think the story gets a little interesting. And really just it's a matter of taking a step back and thinking about it, maybe as an economist would, or thinking about it, you know, through incentives. And it's really on the lender side. So you have the lenders saying, okay, sure, these guys with economic power, as we call it, or financial power, as we call it, are better credit risks. That's by definition. They're less likely to default. On the other hand, they're also more likely to be able to get away with reneging on a loan and getting off free. And what this really means then is, you know, you start thinking, you know, just thinking about incentives here. There's really the way we're thinking about it is there's two types of default. One is what you might call, say, a legitimate default, where you can't default, you default because you legitimately cannot repay the loan. There's another one which you might think of as an illegitimate default, where you default not because you can't repay, but because you don't want to repay. And you know what? You don't want to repay because you know that if it goes to court, you're probably going to win. So those guys then, if you're the lender looking at these guys, or women, obviously, you might say, well, I don't want to lend to these people unless they maybe pay me a little more. So this is where, in a competitive market at least, where you've got lenders who might be able to lend to multiple different people, you know, not necessarily the first person that comes by them, they're not going to give loans to those people with legal power unless those people with legal power pay them a little more. Because it's actually for the same reason as those with financial or less financial power pay more. Namely that those people with less financial power or more legal power, both of those people are more likely to default. Now what we know is true in Ottoman society, and it's true in almost every society, is actually what you were getting at, is that the correlation between economic and legal or financial power is really high. Meaning, you know, if you have high economic power, or financial power rather, you're likely to have some sort of legal power. And in fact, one might even cause the other. You might have legal power precisely because you have financial power, or vice versa. And, you know, to some extent, we certainly think of this as true in the modern developed world today. But this was also certainly true in the Ottoman world. Now, the difference between the Ottoman Empire and the modern world is that this legal power was very strong for certain classes in the Ottoman Empire. Whereas today, there is some legal power for some classes, but really across all different classes, you know, gender, religion, whatever, there isn't that much difference in the modern world. So now what we say is look, you know, there's two countervailing things going on here. On the one hand, what you might call, you know, the people of high socioeconomic status, also they have high financial power, meaning that they're more likely to get loans for cheaper because they're less likely to default. On the other hand, they're also more likely to have high legal power, meaning that they're actually less likely, or that they're going to have to pay more for loans. These are two countervailing things. Now, what we then say is when the courts are sufficiently biased towards, you know, the elites or men or Muslims, that that effect is going to overpower the financial effect. And what you get is people of high socioeconomic status actually end up paying more for loans than people of low socioeconomic status, which is, at least initially, I think, as you mentioned, it was definitely true for us as well. You know, initially, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It's precisely the opposite of what you expect. These things in the modern world are highly negatively correlated, meaning that people of high socioeconomic status pay much less for loans on average than people of lower socioeconomic status. And this is true all over the world. But the difference between the setting we look at, the Ottoman Empire, and the modern developed world, is that, you know, what we're talking about as legal power here is really very small relative to what it was in the Ottoman world, or, you know, in certain parts of the developing world today, and actually really throughout most of economic history, courts were rather biased towards certain groups.
Yeah, I can see how this works. And you think of it initially, the rich are going to get off with cheaper loans. Men will, same thing. It's a patrilineal society kind of thing. But once you mention this, you know, especially with men, it makes sense. You said earlier on that, you know, men can skip town much easier than women can. And so the lender is going to say, whoa, if this person's going to run away, I better at least try to get a little bit more out of interest the first couple months and accumulate some of this back because they're a higher risk. Same thing with elites, I can imagine. Yeah, they control the court. So if they say, I don't want to pay back the loan, they say, what are you going to do? Take me to court, and they're probably going to win. So again, you charge them a little bit more. There must be a curvilinear relationship to this, right? Because if you charge somebody more, if you charge a male more, if you charge a Muslim more, or if you charge somebody elite a lot more, that raises the risk of default, right?
So you might think that there could be a higher, or you can't charge the elite too much, or you can't charge women, or you can't charge men too much because then they'll default. Yeah, but the beauty of this is, on at least the situation we look at, is that these are all people, you know, at least on average, that have a lot of wealth. So charging them a little more interest, or even in some cases a lot more interest, is not really going to dramatically affect the probability that they will legitimately default, because they're going to be able to cover these loans most likely. And you know, some of these loans might be for consumption, or may, you know, and actually a lot of the loans we see probably were, but they were also loans that, you know, they might have been seasonal, or they might have been, you know, consumption smoothing. They were loans that, you know, you would assume at least the elite were likely going to be able to, or were likely going to be able to pay off. Moreover, you know, the other thing is, you know, these were, from all we can tell, you know, they were by no means what, you know, an economist would call perfectly competitive by any means, but they were competitive enough where if you were, say, you know, a bad elite, meaning, you know, you were a bad credit risk, you are just going to have to pay quite a bit more in these markets for that, and really there was no way of getting around this. Now there was nothing like, you know, say credit scores or anything like, you know, we have today, but this is also, you know, a society where there was a little more, you know, sharing of information. You know, Istanbul is a big city. You know, you wouldn't have necessarily known the person you were dealing with, but there were definitely ways of getting some information on the degree to which this person was a credit risk.
Yeah, that's always surprising how things, you know, get around, is that, oh yeah, that's the jerky son of Prince so-and-so, and he's going to skip town too. He never pays anything back. Yeah, which tells you reputation matters quite a bit, and you got to preserve that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Do you have any sense for the magnitude? Are we talking men and elites and Muslims pay 20% more, or is it 2% more? What kind of sense do you get of the difference?
So I mean, we can answer the question quite specifically. So our data, you know, spans these 200 years, and over the 200 year time span, the average real interest rate is around 19%. Obviously, it fluctuates with economic conditions, but hovers right around 19%, which is high, and it's actually high by standards of the day as well. So this is a period where interest rates are falling in much of, you know, at least the developing economies. But so our regression analysis, which, you know, helps us control for a host of different variables, so, you know, keeping the principal constant of the loan, say, and, you know, stuff that you might think is important to determining the interest rate. Elites and men and Muslims pay between 2 and 4 percentage points more on interest, on their interest rate, which, you know, is given that the base rate is 19, it ends up being about 1/6 to 1/4 of the interest rate more. So, you know, something like 15 to 25% more, which is it's a good chunk. In the modern context where interest rates are generally a little lower, that would still be, you know, equivalent to paying an extra percentage point or two for, you know, say a mortgage.
Yeah, and that adds up over time too. Just enough to cover your risk, but not enough to force the person into defaulting because it's too usurious, I guess,
exactly,
to speak.
So and that's what we were just kind of talking about. How the premiums that these guys would have had to pay wasn't so much that it would have really raised the chances of them legitimately defaulting much.
You mentioned that you did a regression on this with data over the course of 200 years, and I'm just absolutely curious on how you get this database. I don't think there was a computer mainframe back then that had this all loaded up, and you just had to push a button and get this all. Where did you get all this information from?
So, yeah, you'd love to say that you did the, you know, we had the this perfect framework, economic framework in mind, and we, you know, say, "Oh, well, where do we go to test it? Let's go gather some data from the Ottoman archives." You know, the other way around. So Timur's actually been Timur Karan, my co-author on this paper, has been working on translating various types of records from the Ottoman or the Istanbul, in particular, archives for the last 10 years. So he has a series of RAs that work in Istanbul, translating these archives. So the Ottomans did keep pretty good records. Now they're all in Ottoman Turkish, which is, you know, the dead language. So you do have to have people that know how to read the language and then transcribe it. So for the last 10 years, he's been translating these records. Now they're all types of records that he's been looking at. In fact, he recently published a 10-volume set on different records, which you know, might be able to link to or something on the website, because it's for people interested in Ottoman economic history, it really is a great resource because everything's translated into English as well, and it's on all aspects of social and economic life in Istanbul as seen through court records. Now, with loans, one thing you could do was, you know, we do have some records of some trials that were where there was some dispute. Maybe somebody didn't pay the loan, and you know, there's some gray area on whether they should have paid the loan back, so they went to court. The main thing that we saw in the data were loans where you could just take it to the court to be registered. So the court kind of acted as maybe a notary would today. So you have some evidence that this loan was taken out for this specific. Well, we actually didn't have purpose, but, you know, at this specific interest rate, we know whether, say, it was a mortgage or whether there was, say, a pawn attached to it, so stuff like that. We know all the aspects of the loan. And, you know, importantly, of course, we know, or we can backtrack the religion of both the borrower and lender, the gender of the borrower and lender, as well as whether they had a title or not. So we can say something about these three characteristics which might have given individuals both financial, but more importantly, legal power in the Ottoman Empire at this time. So this has been a very long project he'd been working on. We look at a slice of this. And so to kind of get at what you were, I think, initially saying, how this is something that was so counterintuitive, when Timur first sent me some of these data, or sorry, it was really just the summary statistics, meaning just, you know, the means, we looked at it and we said, you know, there has to be something wrong here. Maybe our sample size is just too small, because men were paying on average more interest, Muslims were paying on average more interest, titled people were paying on average more interest. And so we just assumed that this was something, or at least I assumed that this was something that was just due to small sample size. So yeah, we, you know, didn't talk about this for a number of months. Then he sent me, a few months later, he sent me something, all right, some more data's come back, and we've increased the sample size, and these effects are even stronger. So that's when we say, all right, well, maybe this is not a bug, but a feature of the data. So that's when we put our heads together, and, you know, we both studied the Ottoman Empire quite a bit. He much more than myself. You know, he's one of the foremost experts on the Ottoman economic history. And, you know, actually quite quickly we realized that this very much could be a result of
the different types of legal institutions that we knew existed in the Ottoman Empire that, you know, we don't think of as really existing today.
I want to give a big shout out to Timur Kuran for doing all this data collection, because he's somebody who's very well known in the field of economic history, and he's one of these people that could just sit back on his laurels and write grand thoughts and punditry and stuff. But he's actually out there, as you said, collecting this 10-volume set of data and publishing it. I mean, just wow. It might not sound interesting. You said we can link to it for all those people interested in the late Ottoman Empire economic history, which I'm sure is most of our audience. But it is an incredible feat. And, you know, what you guys found from that, too, is there's another object lesson for a lot of scholars and students. It's not necessarily finding an answer to something that's most surprising, but sometimes finding the puzzle where you look at it and you say, nah, that can't be right. That's odd. Right, and that it leads to this.
This is precisely the type of thing we don't know of any work in economics that's been done on this. But it's precisely for the reason, if you're just thinking in the modern context, it's not even a question you'd ask, because really what we're defining as legal power here, it's not something that that exists at least in developed economies. So really, you know, the political economy of lending credit markets really plays a very different role in you call them underdeveloped or pre-modern economies than it does today.
Let me push you on that question a little bit more, because this is interesting to me about the generalizability of this. Is this something that this research project, something that really is going to speak to the broader literature on finance and lending in contemporary times or maybe in other parts of the world in economic history? Or is this just a one-off oddball situation that, it's kind of fluky. That's what happened at this time, but it doesn't happen anywhere else. Where are the implications for this?
So yeah, I mean, of course, you know, it's our paper. We think there's plenty of implications here. So to answer both of these questions, within economic history, we know that this type of political economy of biased courts are pretty common. And really, one thing that this is going to be really, I think, help us explain a lot better now when thinking through this logic is one of the big questions in economic history. So one of the, for me and Timur, we both have worked on this, and, you know, as well as many others, one of the big questions is, you know, why Europe? What happened in Europe? What was going on in Europe that propelled it, you know, especially relative, you know, for me and Timur at least, relative to the Middle East. Now, one thing we know that was important was that institutions became impersonalized over time, meaning that your identity didn't matter as much. You know, they became, you know, so, you know, if you were an elite or a non-elite, you know, it didn't really matter as much. You were just as likely to get a fair shake in front of the court. What we've shown here is that can be incredibly important for financial contracts, which in turn can, you know, when we think of lending markets as opening up, you know, that plays a huge role in the bill, you know, in investment in capital and savings, stuff like that. So what we can then say is, well, if we have any type of data on lending, on lending for personal loans, you know, between people, or even between banks, you know, in Europe, if we're talking about Europe and people, that can actually tell us now something about the state of the institutions at the time. Because if people, you know, if people of the higher classes are paying less for loans, it is actually now, it's suggestive then that the legal institutions were working relatively impartially.
Which is a
very difficult thing to actually get. The reason it's difficult for states to have impartial courts is that, you know, is that there's winners and losers from switching to partial to impartial courts. Right? And the people who are the biggest losers are people, you know, who already have contracts out there, you know, the wealthy people who already have loans that, you know, if you switch to an impartial court, all of a sudden they can't renege. So what we know then is that, or what we think of as generalizable here, is really, you know, it's the reverse way around. It's the reverse way. So what we said is that institutions, these political economy institutions, really matter for lending markets. What we're saying now is you can kind of look at these lending, these capital markets, these lending markets, and backtrack what the institutional development must have been like.
Yeah. It's a real neat kind of in backwards induction proxy way of getting at measuring institutions, which are very difficult to measure to begin with.
Yes,
yeah.
Very much so. And this is also true, so yeah, to get to the other part of your question, it's modern-day world as well. You know, now, in most of the developed world, and even really the developing world, courts are impartial enough where what we call the wealth effect matters much more. But we also know that's not true everywhere. And there really has been very little work done on this, you know, in part because data from those parts of the world are harder to get. But we also now at least can recognize that this is one more impediment in countries with, you know, what you might call bad institutions need to overcome. Now, I think a positive or an optimistic side of this, and we also saw this in the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century, was that when reforms do start to take place, this partiality thing that we really highlight here is probably going to be one of the first things to be reformed. Now, the reason we argue for this, and we see this in the 1830s in the Ottoman Empire when a series of reforms known as the Tanzimat starts being pushed through, is that if you think about it, who are the people in power? In the Ottoman Empire, they're the male Muslim elites. Now, if you're going to have a reform, who are the people most likely going to benefit from these reforms? Male Muslim elites. So what type of reform might they want to push through? You know, something that, you know, makes the courts relatively impartial, because that actually benefits the male Muslim elites in this case, as a whole, at least.
And does that have a spillover effect to other aspects of civil contracting, not just lending, right?
Oh, yeah, any type of civil contracting. So one thing we mentioned in the paper is that, you know, it doesn't even have to be, you know, what we think of as people of high socioeconomic status that benefit. In fact, often it isn't. Yeah, so there's this great example that we actually heard a couple of times from different people when we presented this at different places, that in Brazil, it's extremely hard to evict someone. So what, you know, so essentially what this means is that, you know, there's essentially a legal status or legal power built in for renters, which, you know, the purpose of the law, of course, is to help the poor, you know, to help the poor from, you know, indiscriminate eviction by, you know, greedy landlords. What this ends up happening, of course, or what ends up happening as a result, of course, is that the poor aren't able to rent. So what you get in these major cities in Brazil are the rich are actually the renters. In the big cities, the rich mainly rent, and the poor all own their houses. But the poorest houses are, you know, are shanties, essentially, on the outskirts of town. So, you know, it's essentially, you know, just like with the Ottoman Empire case, there's really unintended consequences that arise from these laws, which are not impartially enforced.
Yeah, and absolutely fascinating. It just kind of flip-flops everything that we think about in terms of it. Hey, let me ask you, you just mentioned that the reforms were starting to happen in the 1830s. Was there anything that gave impetus to these reform movements to do this? Was this all of a sudden competition from Europe and we better westernize our ways or get swallowed up, or what was happening?
Yeah, pretty much what you say. There's been a pretty large literature on this, and my reading of it is that the standard story is that By the mid-19th century, the Ottomans really realized that they had fallen far behind. And so they started adopting Western legal forms, so they, you know, reduced the role that Sharia law plays, certainly in commercial contracting. It's all European types of institutions. It's mainly institutions, in particular legal ones, that they adopt in this period. And again, one of the things that they make clear is that the law in terms of contracts is meant to be impartially enforced.
You mentioned Europe here, and I want to finish off with some comparative reflections on your part. You've written on the topic of interest bands in medieval Christianity too. So do you see any parallels or differences or potential lessons that you can draw between that comparison?
Yeah, very much so. So this is actually, so this part of the book we mentioned in the beginning really focuses on this, and that interest restrictions almost serve as a microcosm of what was going on in the medieval period between and these differences that emerge over time between Europe and the Middle East. So as of, you know, say 1000, 1200 or so, the Middle East was pretty far ahead of Western Europe. We know that, you know, we don't know the exact date. You could have 100 historians saying 100 different answers, but by about 1600, and certainly by 1700, the positions of the Middle East and Western Europe had very clearly switched. So one thing that's going on in Europe is there's, you know, all these institutional developments that really respond to the economic environment. And you see a lot less of that in the Ottoman Empire. And why I said interest restrictions serve as a microcosm of this is precisely the period in which interest restrictions more or less become a dead letter in Europe. There are restrictions on taking interest in Christianity that were imposed in the year 325 of the Council of Nicaea that remain the law of the land in Christian territories, certainly until the 11th century or so. But this is also the period, starting in the 11th, late 10th century, where commerce starts to revive in Europe. And what you pretty soon start to see after that is all these secular leaders permitting interest. You know, what they're essentially doing is responding to the economic environment. You know, they're responding to, you know, their merchants rather than maintaining these religious laws. Whereas in the Middle East, you know, there was actually even a greater impetus to respond to merchants and other people involved in commerce. But the Middle Eastern rulers never fully alleviate these laws. And in part, and what I argue in this book and have argued elsewhere, is that this really has to do with the role that religious scholars played, or religious authorities played, in legitimizing rule. You know, it was just more costly for the Sultan or the Middle Eastern ruler to go against his religious authority than it was the Western European ruler. Now, you know, ultimately what that means is you get all these different types of organizational forms that build upon each other, like banks start to emerge in Western Europe, because, you know, when you can freely lend an interest and you can say this is an interest-bearing loan and you don't have to worry about whether it's going to be undermined in the court, that's when you can start getting institutional buildup and you can really get capital pooling and stuff like this, whereas in the Middle East, you don't see this. You know, and just in the context of, you know, just purely lending, which is what, you know, in this one, you know, important but small part of the overall economy, you don't see any type of buildup like this in the Middle East. Lending remains, you know, what we call personal, meaning, you know, between two people that know each other in one way, shape, or form, maybe have a repeat relationship, it might be kin, something like that. And you don't see, you know, major capital pooling, things like this. And there's other reasons too, and actually Timur Turan has written a lot on some of the other reasons, like inheritance law, laws on partnership, things like this, that also have a dampening effect on commerce. But one thing that his work also has in common with all of this is this also all fell under the Sharia law, which a sultan or, you know, a Middle Eastern ruler would have been very loath to alter, because it would have undermined his primary source of legitimacy. The church just wasn't, while we think of the medieval church as being really strong in Europe, it was also often in conflict with rulers.
The role that the religious scholars played is a really fascinating topic that I think we could probably spend another hour talking about, and we're going to have to get you back on the show to do that. But with the few minutes we have remaining here, looking back at all the research that you did, and this is a project that took some time, gathering the data and such, and thinking about what it really meant, what kind of general reflections do you have on what you've learned beyond what you've told us here?
So, I mean, I think there's a few. One that might, you know, only or interest more the academic side of your audience is that, you know, going into data with a really open mind and having no idea what the question you're going to ask is can be really fruitful, because that's what we did. We essentially were just started looking at these data, thinking it would be interesting to see, you know, what really affected interest rates in this kind of period. We thought was interesting for other reasons, but we had no idea that this was going to be the questions we were asking. We didn't even really think that, you know, we weren't thinking of these biases in courts at all. And it turned out to be this you know, light bulb moment we had where it really occurred to us that we were getting at something much bigger than just the Ottoman Empire. And the other things that I think, you know, we can take from this that I at least take from this is that, you know, that history, even in a region of the world where, you know, I find important, Timur definitely finds important, and, you know, many find important, but many also might not, or, you know, might have little interest in, you know, certainly the Ottoman Empire. You know, it doesn't really matter where you're necessarily getting your data from. You know, you can really pull some insights from any period in history in any place, and really it's actually the variation for me in the different places. You know, at least for me, you know, our mindsets are so set in this, you know, Western way. You know, we have the institutions that we live in day by day that dictate a lot of, you know, the economic outcomes that we see. And really putting our mind in a different institutional environment, yeah, it can really be enlightening in undermining these things that you take for granted as these, you know, general connections. Even as an economist, I'm always thinking in terms of incentives, but it's still, you know, it's still hard to escape, you know, the institutions that you grew up in. I think these are the big things that I think, yeah, there's some really general lessons here to be learned.
Yeah, history is always a good teacher, and it's, you know, keeping your eye open to different places and different times that can tell us a lot about the situation that we live in today, and that's one of the things that we find through a lot of our historical podcast here on Research on Religion. My guest today has been Jared Rubin. Jared, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Pleasure, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.